Well, I'm sure we're aware of the fact that the world is bracing for another new year, and there are already concerns for ISIS attacks occurring at large venues. For instance, the Rose Parade in Pasadena, the organizers there are closing off a number of streets because they do not want these huge 18-wheeler trucks to be used to come in and to plow into the crowds. And then Times Square in New York is all going to be cordoned off by empty garbage trucks being placed in strategic places so trucks can't get through to the crowds. So there's going to be a lot of visible security at a number of those type of events, and it shows the type of world in which we're living. But something else happens as the new year begins, and that is that there are a lot of drunken celebrations and a lot of immoral activity occurs. In fact, there's some websites where you could go to the most sinful places on New Year's Eve. You know, you click, I haven't clicked on there, but it just advertises it, the most sinful places where to go. In fact, drug and alcohol-related accidents and deaths occur at this time of year more than any other time during the full year. Now, some people say, well, I don't get into all of that stuff, and I don't get into that activity, so isn't it still okay to participate in New Year's Eve celebrations? That's a relevant question that we have before us today because, you know, tonight is New Year's Eve according to the world. So that's one question. There's another question we need to ask, and that is, what would God have us do? What would God have us do? Now, as Christians, we need to look through everything we do with the eyes of God and look at things from His point of view, the godly point of view. Of course, we recognize that God is not human. He's spirit, and He's not limited by time. For God, a thousand years is as one day. A thousand years is one day with God. But did God ever intend for humanity to celebrate January 1st as the beginning of a year? And so today we need to answer a number of these questions. So the title of the sermon is New Year's Day. Now, let's ask, first of all, when does a new year actually begin? Well, we have to go back to the beginning. Let's look at Genesis 1, verse 14. Now, this was after the time of verse 2, when the earth was without form and void, when it had been tohu and bohu, full of confusion. And we find in the next couple of verses here in Genesis a recreation. And we begin to see in verse 14 that God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night. Let them be for signs, seasons, days, and years. Let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. And it goes on to verse 18 that gave light to the earth to rule over the day and over the night, to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. The evening and the morning were the fourth day. Many of us know that occurred on the fourth day. And so we see a number of things here. A day. He said that these were for days and years in verse 14. When does a day begin? Now, the world says the day begins at 12 o'clock midnight. It's not what God says. God says, and we saw it here in verse 19 and then verse 13, the evening and the morning were the third day. God is telling us that a day according to how he wants us to look at a day begins at evening to evening, sunset to sunset. So this is the Sabbath day. It is the seventh day, and it began last night at sunset and will end at sunset. Okay, so we have the beginning of the day, and the day is determined by, you know, the rotation of the earth, one rotation. Now a year is determined by how long it takes for that earth to rotate around the sun. We're told when a day begins, when does the year begin? According to God, when does the year begin? Well, let's look at Exodus 12 and verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt. This month shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. God is specifically telling Israel, despite all the Egyptian calendar that they had, this is what I want you, or the Babylonian calendar, I want you to begin looking at the year beginning in this month. And so if this is the first month, you would deduce that the first day of the first month would be the beginning of a new year. And so we begin to see this. Now, it's the first month. Now, a month is determined by the rotation of the moon around the earth. It's fascinating to think that the earth rotates, the moon rotates, and they both rotate constantly around the sun. This is an amazing thing that God created. The moon determines the seasons and the months. And this month here is the beginning. When is this month? Well, we find a little bit of information here that this is the beginning of the months, and this is when God is going to be taking Israel out of Egypt. So it's in the spring of the year. We know that on the 14th day would be the Passover, and then the days of unleavened bread. But let's look at the name of the month, Deuteronomy 16. Deuteronomy 16. In verse 1, observe the month of Abib and keep the Passover to the Lord your God, for in the month of Abib the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. Of course, then you're to keep the Passover. So Abib here in the Hebrew means green ears. Green ears, it's the spring of the year. Now, it's interesting to note that this name is also, the name of this month is also called the month of Nisan. The month of Nisan. And that's, we won't turn there, but that's found in Esther 3 and in verse 7. And that's the name that was given to this month after the Babylonian captivity. But one thing's for sure, Abib or Nisan are not in the dead of winter. It's in the springtime. So God determined that the year would begin in the first month that was called Nisan or Abib when they left Egypt. Now, let's look at Leviticus 23, verse 23. Leviticus 23, verse 23. Because we see something else that's brought out here. And this is the only holy day that is listed to begin on the first of any month. And here you find the first of the seventh month. The Lord spoke to Moses, speak to the children of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, you shall have a Sabbath rest, a memorial of blowing of trumpets. We know this is the Feast of Trumpets. It's on the first day of the seventh month, the new year, the new moon, When the new moon occurs, that is the beginning of the month, the first of the month. The Jews call this day Rosh Hashanah. Now, Rosh Hashanah means head of the year. And so there's been some confusion. Well, if we're seeing the beginning of the year in the spring, and yet you see Rosh Hashanah as the head of the year in the fall, then what does that mean? Well, the Jews actually look at the first of the year in the spring as the beginning of the religious year. But they look at Rosh Hashanah as the beginning of the civil year. And that's why sometimes it's very difficult to figure out when a king came to power and when he left power, because was it according to the reckoning of the first month, beginning of the religious year, or of the civil year, you know, the Feast of Trumpets, when that began. In fact, the Hebrew calendar actually relies on the establishment of the first day of the seventh month in every year to be able to calculate all of the other holy days when they begin. It's just a fascinating study. We won't go into the calendar today. There's a paper, a study paper about it on the website in case you're interested in to get it into further detail about it. But what we look at, what God is saying here, Feast of Trumpets is in the seventh month. The first month is in the spring of the year, Abib or Nisan. And that's when God starts the year. So you see that the day begins at sunset. The month begins with the new moon. And the year begins in the spring of the year, first of the first month. That's determined Nisan. Now, we know that the world doesn't use the Hebrew calendar. Basically, the Jews use it. There are different calendars that are being used throughout the world. But the one that we're using in this modern age in the Western world was actually developed by Julius Caesar in 46 BC. It's known as the Julian calendar. And he began the new year with January 1st. Now later, there were some problems with the Julian calendar, and it was drifting out of season, and the spring equinox was drifting out of the spring of the year, too far away from the spring equinox. So in 1582, Pope Gregory reformed the calendar. And in order to keep the calendar from drifting out of season and to put these Easter by the spring equinox. And when he did that, when he reformed the calendar, he kept much of the Julian calendar. But he added, you know, a few extra leap years, and there's a lot of detail we won't go into. But the Western world basically lives by the Gregorian calendar, but it has a lot of the Julius Caesar additions initiations that he put into the calendar. The question is, why January 1st? Why did Caesar choose January 1st? I want to quote from an article that came out in the U.S. News and World Report. This goes back to 1996. However, you can find it on a website called simpletoremember.com. Simple to Remember. And in this website, it says, in 46 B.C., Roman Emperor Julius Caesar established January 1st as New Year's Day. They give the reason why. And it was based to honor the god Janus. Janus was the Roman god of doors and gates. And he had two faces. One would look forward and one would look backward. Sometimes you see faces, one face this way and one face this way, or one face this way, one face that way. Two faces. One looking forward, one looking back. Caesar felt that the month named after this god, January, would be the appropriate door to the year. So he named a full month, January, after the god Janus. And he named the first day of that first month the new year, January 1st, the appropriate door to the year. And I want to read a little bit more about Janus, this god. This is from talesbeyondbelief.com. Janus was usually depicted with two faces, and in his special function as the doorkeeper of heaven, he was portrayed as standing erect, and he had a key in one hand and a rod or a scepter in the other hand. Have we all seen pictures of the old man going out? He's all old and shriveled, but he's holding on to a staff. Where does that come from? Well, this was the old portrait of Janus. This comes from Digital Gothic Net website. The tradition of using a baby. How often have we seen that? The old man going out and then the baby, you know, all dressed in this little basket and or whatever, or some ribbons around it. You probably see 2017 on the baby, and the old guy going out is 2016. Where'd the baby come from? According to this article, it signified what was done in Greece around 600 BC. It was their tradition at that time, during the new year, when their new year began, to celebrate their god of wine, Dionysus, by parading a baby around in a basket, representing the annual rebirth of that god as the spirit of fertility. And early Egyptians also used a baby as a symbol of rebirth when they began their new year. So we got both ideas, the old man and the young baby, from paganism. Pagan ideas. It's not in the Bible. And it's also interesting that the early Christians, and this is according to the Catholic Encyclopedia, and we're talking about the Catholic Church, they actually denounced this as pagan. They were forced then to reevaluate their position because all these pagans were coming into the church, the universal church at that time. And so they allowed to celebrate the new year with a baby, but this time it'll be the baby Jesus. And we'll get into that in a little bit. So January 1st was set aside to worship Janus. Not much has changed. The world doesn't know this. It doesn't know it. A lot of noise making takes place. Why are all the noise making taking place? Why do they have all this racket going on and all this fireworks and everybody yelling and cheering? Why is that? Because in ancient tradition, it was done to ward off the evil spirits. Keep them evil spirits away. So we've got to make a lot of noise. And it's done on New Year's Eve. Okay. I want to go back to this the United States and World Report article. Caesar celebrated January 1st. His first January 1st, you know what he did? He went and ordered the violent routing of a revolutionary Jewish forces in the Galilee. He ordered a routing of the Jews. And experts say, eyewitnesses say of the account at that time, that blood flowed in the streets. So great worship of the first day of the new year, he goes out and kills a bunch of Jews, you know, over in Galilee. In later years, Roman pagans observed the new year by engaging in drunken orgies, a ritual they believed constituted a personal reenacting of the chaotic world that existed before the cosmos was ordered by the gods. Now, what did we read in Genesis? We know that there was chaos. God created the heavens and the earth, and then there was chaos. We know there was a great battle. Satan tried to kick God out of heaven. And so there's that long period of time between that chaos and then the earth was established by God and the Word. Well, here they're saying, well, you know, we got to celebrate these drunken orgies. And we are reenacting that chaotic world. But it was all settled now by the gods. And again, all pagan, all found in mythology. And there's a total abandonment of morality. Let's go to 1 Peter 4, verse 3. 1 Peter 4, verse 3. 1 Peter 4, in verse 3. First Peter 4, verse 3. We have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles when we walked in lewdness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. In regard to these, they think it strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. Some people think we're missing out on all the fun. We're missing out on life. And they get annoyed, you know, when we don't join them. So we need to avoid the revelries that we were once a part of. The Greek word for revelries comes from cosmos, meaning a letting loose, a boisterous merrymaking. Thayer's Greek lexicon says komos is a nocturnal, meaning nightly, and riotous procession of half-drunken and frolicsome fellows who after supper parade through the streets with torches and music in honor of Bacchus or some other deity and sing and play before the houses of their male and female friends. And they generally used a feast of drinking parties that are protracted till late at night and indulge in revelry. What do you think is going to happen tonight in most venues? A lot of people are going to get drunk. And it's going to go all the way on throughout the morning, into the morning, and you'll have millions of people with hangovers tomorrow, horrible headaches. So what the pagans did on New Year's Eve is being replayed every year. A digital Gothic Net continues with these interesting things here. When Caesar reformed the calendar, the Senate rewarded Caesar by actually having the month of Quintilius renamed July. So the month of July is named after Julius Caesar because of his calendar, because of putting forth the calendar. Caesar's grandnephew, the Emperor Augustus, well, he had a similar honor bestowed upon him because he found that Julius Caesar only added 3 leap years, and when there should have been actually 4, you know, 4 years in a leap year, not just 3, but 4. So the Senate gave him the honor of renaming the month Sextilis to August. So you got January named after the god Janus. You got July named after Julius Caesar, who established January 1st as the new year. And then you got Augustus, August, who helped reform that same calendar. The names of our months, the names of the days of the week, you know, have a lot of Roman origin. You know what the Bible calls the days of the week? Day 1, day 2, the 7th day. It's the 7th day. 7th day is the Sabbath. You don't find very many names of the months listed in the Bible, except for like Abib or Nisan, but you have the 6th month, the 7th month, the 9th month. And I often wonder what it will be in the millennium when all these names are being changed and what God's going to call the names of the days and the names of the weeks, I mean the names of the months and the years, etc. So I just wonder. Also, in the same article that ancient Romans gave gifts to one another on New Year's, they gave gold-colored coins or nuts imprinted with the pictures of Janus. And the emperors then began to demand that people give gifts to them. Because, see, they were God. They were gods in the flesh. The emperors were considered gods in the flesh at that time. And actually, what's interesting is that the Catholic Church actually outlawed all of these observances and customs in 567 A.D. as being too pagan, Well, as it expanded, as the Catholic Church expanded, and this is in the same encyclopedia here, the same article, became more widespread, that as the Romans celebrated the New Year, the Catholic Church worshiped what is still called by some as the Feast of Christ's Circumcision. Remember the little baby? Well, okay, December 25th, they believe he was born. Okay, 8 days later, why would they even acknowledge that you'd want to keep the 8 days of circumcision as the Hebrews do? But anyway, that's just an aside. But they would say then that the 1st of January was the celebration of Christ's circumcision. Of course, that's nowhere found in the Bible. And then the church went back and forth over this, whether they should, you know, celebrate the new year. And it wasn't until about the late 1500s that January 1st became the official new year for Western nations. I want to mention something else from history.com. The practice of making resolutions for the new year is thought to have first caught on among the ancient Babylonians, even before the Romans, who made promises in order to earn the favor of the gods and start the year off on the right foot. So the idea of resolutions was to favor the gods, and so that they would, you know, I'll do this if you do this for me. And so a lot of them would pay off their debts and return farm equipment and everything like that. Now, it's not wrong to resolve to better your life. I mean, we all want to do that. We all want to become better people and better Christians. There's nothing wrong with that, as we see here in verse 7 to 10. Let's look at verse 7 to 10. The end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be serious and watchful in your prayers, and above all things, have fervent love for one another. For love will cover a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without grumbling. And as each one has received a gift, minister it to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. So we're all supposed to do better in our lives. We're supposed to love one another. We're supposed to have the love of God, and we're supposed to serve others. Nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with us starting to do good on any day of the week throughout the year. In fact, since the new year in God's eyes begins on the first day of the first month, that's the same month that we keep the Passover, the day that we memorialize the death of Christ, and we are committing ourselves once again to live in that way. I mean, that would be even the better time to start living a better life. But still, we should be determined to resolve to live better every day of the week. I mean, every day of the year, and not just at the first of the new year. Let's look at this ancient warning to Israel, Deuteronomy 12. I know it's getting a little warm in here, or at least I'm getting warm, but we're almost finished. Let's look at Deuteronomy 12, verse 29. Deuteronomy 12, verse 29. When the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I will do so likewise. Don't go after these gods. Don't do like they did. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. For every abomination to the Lord, he hates. Which he hates, they've done to their gods. They even burned their own kids in the fire. Whatever I command you, you be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it, nor take away from it. So we're not to worship the Lord our God in such a way as the ancient pagans. So how are we to worship God? What does the word worship really mean? In this passage, the word in Greek means do so. Do so. You shall not do so to the Lord your God. In other places, you are to do so. We see this same word, the same passage, the same phrase in these verses here within the chapter, verse 14. But in the place which the Lord your God chooses, in one of your tribes, there you shall offer your burnt offerings. There you shall do all that I command you. Same phrase that could be translated worship. You shall do. You should do. So do. Verse 25. You shall not eat it, that it may go well with you and your children after you, that you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. Same phrase that here is translated worship in verse 31 is you shall do. You do what is right in the sight of the Lord. And then notice verse 28. Same wordage. Observe and obey all these words that I command you, that it may go well with you and your children after you forever. When you do what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God. We could put it there, when you worship what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God, or when you worship God, or you worship God by doing what is good, to do so. Now let's look at the word in the New Testament. John 4, verse 24. John 4, verse 24. Here's how we are told to worship God. John 4, verse 24. God is spirit. Those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. Now this is a particular interesting word in the Greek. It comes from proskynio. Proskynio comes from two words, towards, to kiss. That's what worship in the Greek means, towards, to kiss. Or as in Help Word Study says, to kiss the ground when prostrating before a superior, to worship, to fall down and honor one on one's knees, to do obeisance, which we would do before God. Another basic meaning, in the opinion of most scholars, is to kiss. To kiss God. I find that interesting because we're told to worship God in spirit and in truth. Not only outwardly do we show obeisance, you know, by our bowing when we pray to God and we come before him in humbleness, but as a kiss. As a kiss. In the New Testament, what God is showing us through these words is that we're to worship him in spirit and truth, not only physically bowing, but in our minds as well. How do we approach God mentally? How do we do this? It should be in the same manner as we find there in the New Old Testament and in the New Testament. Let's look at Luke 4, verse 8. Because this word was used by Jesus Christ, or at least it's translated in the Greek as this, towards, to kiss. Luke 4, verse 8. This is what Christ said to Satan. Get behind me, Satan, for it is written, you shall toward a kiss the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve. Now, what's also interesting about this statement is this is a quote from Deuteronomy 10, verse 20. And Deuteronomy 10, verse 20 is using a word that means cling. Cling and cleave to God, to be close to God. So when you look at all what these Hebrew words are saying and putting them all together, we're not to worship the gods of the world, but we're to worship God in this way. We are to do so, what God commands. We are to physically bow down before him, and we do that in our prayers. We bow our head. You know, when we pray, you know, at the closing prayer, we all bow our heads in honor of God, to honor God. And in a sense, we need to be so close to God that we cleave to him, that we cling to him even so much as to kiss God. Growing up, I knew what it was like to kiss my dad. And there was a bond there. God wants us to have that close bond with him. We cleave to God, to kiss God. Now this, we can't do it right now because we're physical and God is spirit. But it's the attitude we have to have. In spirit and truth, that's how we worship God. Notice now, finally, Revelation 22, verse 8. Revelation 22 and in verse 8. And this is when John saw this vision, and he heard and saw, and I fell to worship before the feet of the angel who showed me these things. And he said to me, see that you do not do that. Don't worship me. The angel said, don't worship me. I am your fellow servant and of your brethren the prophets and of those who keep the words of this book. We keep the words of this book. We're doing so what God wants. And the angel says, worship God. And it's that word there about toward a kiss. And so all of that put together, we worship God. Nothing else, nobody else but God. So as we do enter a new year according to man's calendar, we need to avoid the paganism that's out there and the evils of sin, but rather cling to God and do so of all of his commands.